I'm Tony Smith, and welcome to Catalina Film Radio. In Jerry and Mike Thompson's latest feature film, Popovich and the Voice of the Fabled American West, Popovich, played by real-life circus star Gregory Popovich, is an ex-circus legend struggling as a street performer in the Wild West streets of Las Vegas.
Listen, Mr. Popovich, it's clear that you care about these animals. But once you shelter an animal, it becomes your pet. And there are very strict laws about how many pets you can have inside the city limits. I'm afraid many of these animals are going to have to go to the pound.
What can I do? These are my friends. They trust me.
Today on the show, I'm speaking with writer, director, editor, and director of photography Jerry Thompson from Las Vegas, who shares the writing, directing, and editing credits for Popovich with his brother, Mike Thompson. All right, well, Jerry, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here.
What got you into filmmaking? How long have you and your brother been working together on projects like this?
We never owned a video camera growing up, but I whenever I could get my hands on one, I'd make movies. I started doing that when I was 10 or 11 years old. Mike co-directs with me. He's 7 years younger than me. So I got into film school and started making movies, and he was in high school, and he, you know, acted in a few and helped me out, and then he entered film school too. And then shortly thereafter, I went into business and he worked another place, and then we've worked together for, I think around 7 years now. Yeah, we've written and directed probably, 15 or 20 short films together over the last few years. So, and we co-directed short films and stuff in film school before he actually started working with me full time too. I think our first short film we made together was probably, I'm thinking about it, 15 years ago. But we have our website called lightforgestudios.com. And we have a ton of work on there. We have probably 10 or 12 of our short films, the more recent ones, and maybe 8 or 9 music videos.
Do you have a preference on the types of projects that you like to work on? Do you prefer short forms or music videos or feature length?
Well, we enjoy everything. We've made 2 features, and obviously that's more substantial, and you get a little more, you get a little more respect and credibility when you make features. I think my preference is definitely features. They're just such a large undertaking, and they're kind of expensive and take up a year of your life, so it takes a while to get those off the ground. So I love shorts because you can just bang one out and enjoy it, and the gratification is a little more instant, but it's also a little more fleeting.
What were some of the filmmakers or the early influences on you that got you bit with the film bug?
Well, what's funny is I didn't realize that's what I wanted to do early on. I mean, I always loved making movies just because I like telling stories and writing and all that. And it's a fun way to do things with friends and stuff. I had never met anyone who made movies, so the stuff I did when I was little, it's not like there was any education or intelligence behind it. It was just making funny stuff. I actually, when I was in high school, thought I wanted to be a cartoonist. I did editorial artwork and stuff like that, and I drew a comic strip in college. I was actually a biochemistry major for the first 2 or 3 years, and I drew a comic strip in college and got a job doing caricatures at the Excalibur. All of a sudden, I was making a living drawing, which was really fun, and prompted me to switch majors and do something I enjoyed in college, because I definitely wanted to finish college, but I kind of realized that probably wasn't. I just wanted to do something artistic. So I didn't actually switch to be a film student until I was already a senior in college. So I guess, like, early influences, it's interesting. There's a guy named Bert Brevid. He does a comic strip called Bloom County, and that was probably, honestly, I think that was probably the biggest creative influence when I was, 15 or 16. I was a huge fan, and I wanted to do my dream job at the time was to do a comic strip in the newspaper, but it's kind of a dying profession, sadly.
Have you wanted to take a stab at animation?
Yeah, actually, I've been trying to teach myself that. I've done a little bit of it, and I actually just signed up. There's a guy out in Boulder City who is kind of a Maya guru. I'm going to start taking classes with him tomorrow. Oddly enough, I actually just went to SIGGRAPH for a week to kind of try to get better at doing some visual effects and things like that. And I actually think, character animation is something I really definitely want to get into, so I'm going to start pursuing that kind of aggressively.
How does the partnership work between you and your brother in terms of this film, Popovich? How do you work with your brother on a film like this?
I mean, it's cool working with your brother because we have pretty similar sensibilities, and a lot of the time we keep each other from being too satisfied. Like, very often when we're working together, something will bother one of us, but the other one will think it's fine. But by the time we kind of work through it and make sure we're both happy, it's always better, even if one of us was happy with it or satisfied with it before the other one was. And on set, the last couple things we've done, it's not always this way, but on Popovich, I had a tendency to kind of focus, you know, I was the cinematographer too, so I had a tendency to be kind of focusing on getting the crew ready and getting all the lights set up and talking through all of the technical stuff. And meanwhile, Mike would be kind of explaining the blocking to the actors and kind of getting them ready. And then once we're actually shooting, you know, we both give direction and all that, but it was kind of cool for us to be able to, it's sort of like, instead of having your attention divided, we were both kind of focused on those two aspects, and it sort of come together once really, you know, we both offered direction to whoever needed it.
The old Hollywood adage says, never work with kids and animals. You guys certainly worked with both on this film. What were some of the challenges or some of the more interesting stories when you were working with the variety of wildlife on this film?
Well, what's funny is, you know, Gregory's animals are all really, you know, they're really professional. He has a show on the Strip, and they're the most impeccably trained animals I've ever seen. So, you know, they're very cooperative. The only one interesting funny thing is, like, if you're getting behind on your day or, you know, you're running along with people, you can try to rally the troops and power through it. But with animals, you don't push them too hard. When they get tired, you stop because, you know, A, you can't force an animal to do something they don't want to do, and B, you wouldn't want to because it's just not a cool thing to do. So for us, I actually kind of loved it because when the animals were getting tired and it wasn't working, we just would have to stop. And it's like, well, it kind of gives you license to, you know, a lot of the time force yourself to have reasonable hours, which was actually kind of a delightful thing. There was a goose that was in the movie, and he pooped on one of our crew, which, you know, he didn't like, but we all thought that was pretty funny. So
accidentally, or did Gregory train him to do that too?
Well, who's to say? Gregory certainly wouldn't admit it, and the goose was keeping quiet, but and then the shot didn't even make it in the movie. It was part of a dream sequence where a guy had to lift his goose up into the shot, and it pooped all over his shoulder and down his back. It was pretty foul. It was bad news.
Well, there was certainly a delightful Charlie Chaplin-esque, you know, tramp character in Popovich. It was such a fun, you know, homage to Chaplin, even maybe a little Dr. Doolittle. Was that character something that Gregory had already perfected and just kind of brought and delivered to you, or was that character something that you guys had to work on together to develop for the film?
Oh no, yeah, he's been developing that for 20 or 30 years. That's been part of his act forever. It's interesting, you know, he's so good at so many things. Like, he has all these photos of himself. He's like a fifth-generation Russian circus guy. You know, and in Russia, the circus is really serious.
Were the photos in the film his actual family photos?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything you said there was true, as far as that goes. The film's obviously certainly not autobiographical in any way, but a lot of his character's background is true. Because, yeah, those pictures of him in black and white, that was his grandparents doing that same dog trick he does at the end. You know? So he says circus families going back 100 years. And he takes it very seriously and takes a lot of pride in it. And he's been juggling since he was 8 years old. He's got photos of himself being trained by his dad since he was a little kid. And then he grew up in the circus, mostly juggling. That's what he started doing, kind of doing juggling and balancing stuff. And he does that ladder act, which was always kind of his trademark. But then he always really liked the clowns, so he started training to do some clowning too. And he's developed a love for that. He always loved Chaplin and physical comedy and all that kind of stuff, and started incorporating that. But early on in his career, he was mostly a juggler, and then he started incorporating more of the physical comedy and that kind of thing. But he loves that. He's really good at all that. And in his act on the Strip, you know, all of the costumes and everything he wore, that's part of his act that he does every day. There's no visual effects or any kind of fakery going on with any of his acts or any of the stuff he actually does. That was all 100% true. It's gotten so natural that it's pretty effortless for him. When he was, I don't want to say when he was in his prime, because that's unkind, but when he was like in his 20s, he had this signature finale that you should try to find it online. It'll shatter your brain, because he would juggle on top of the ladder. You know, he'd be doing five clubs, and juggling five clubs is hard. Most people only do three, but he'd be juggling five clubs on this, you know, 12-foot ladder, and then for his finale, you know, he would start to catch them all. But before he'd catch them all, he would throw one of them up and back really high, and he would catch them all and tip backwards. And when the ladder was at about 45 degrees, he would do a backflip off of it and land in a crouch and hold his hand out, and the first club that he threw would just land in his hand. You know, he can't be doing backflips off ladders anymore. But, man, when you see it, it's like, holy crap, you should... He has a website called ComedyPed.com. I think this footage of him doing that is insane.
That's incredible. Is there a crazy story for how you guys met?
Honestly, it's not that crazy. I was renting, you know, I own a small production company, and I was based in the building of the company that owns the theater where he performs. And I can't remember what, I think it was about 10 years ago. So he had just moved in, and so he needed some new promo video shots. So they suggested us, and we went and shot it. And it's funny, he had an idea for like a children's TV show that he wanted to shoot. And so after I shot his show, he follows me out into the parking garage. He's trying to explain this children's TV show to me. He's being very respectful. He handed me this little binder full of broken English and half Russian ideas. And it's funny, I'm sitting here chatting with him, and he had a half face full of clown makeup, and he's just talking to me like that's normal. And at the time, I wasn't used to it. I'm used to it now, so I don't even notice. But I remember being distracted by this guy with that, you know, it was like half wiped off, so it was like horror movie time. And he's pitching me this children's TV show, and he looks like a horror movie clown. and you know, and I was like, yeah, you know, I didn't know if he knew what was all involved. It sounded real ambitious. And then he came over to my house to look at the footage and looked at it for about 10 seconds and was just like, okay, yeah, let's shoot this TV show. And I'm like, man, this guy moves fast. He just decides and goes. He barely knows me, and he only watched like 10 seconds of what we shot. But yeah, within a month or two, we were just shooting this weird children's TV show that he was sort of making up as he went. But the stunts were amazing. It ended up being, a lot of it was pretty good. But anyway, that's how we met. I worked with him trying to make this thing for that TV show for like, it was like 8 years ago. But yeah, we're going to reincorporate some of the ideas into another movie probably.
So was it the children's show that led to the idea for this feature-length film?
Well, no, not really. That's how we met and started working together. And then a few years down the road, we were pretty friendly. And then actually really what happened was we made a feature film a few years ago called Phil at the Bus Stop. And he did a little cameo at the end of that. And, you know, we had some success in terms of independent films as far as doing film festivals and enjoying some screenings. And he came and saw that and kind of got excited by it. Started saying he wanted to do a movie. Figured, you know, kind of doing selling movies easier than trying to sell a whole TV show. So we just started talking about it, and he had ideas, and we had ideas, and, you know, and we wrote it for him, and that was that. It came together, and it was a lot of fun.
I'm Tony Smith, and you're listening to Catalina Film Radio. With me today is Jerry Thompson, writer, director, editor, and director of photography of the family feature film Popovich and the voice of the fabled American West.
If you could just stand right over there, please. All right. Introducing. Actually, you know what? Drum roll. You know, drum roll? Drum roll? There we go. Introducing the Triple 21,000 Super Blaster. Patent pending, of course.
Cool.
This right here is the best smoke machine ever forged by man, and I should know because I'm the man who forged it, and I did the research. Also, drew that sweet little robot face right there. You, want to see it in action?
Please.
That's cool. That is cool.
The Vegas backdrop plays a role in the film as well. Was that a necessity? Was there any other location considered, or did you know from the get-go you wanted to have the film set in Vegas?
No, we pretty much had to do it in Vegas because, you know, it's where we all live, so we just did it. But it also made sense. You know, we kind of wrote it around that. You know, he's actually been pretty successful here, but we just thought it'd be interesting to have, you know, this guy who used to be in the circus kind of came out here to chase the dream or whatever, and it didn't really work out. We don't really go into why, but, you know, it's kind of like for a performer, Vegas is good. It's like if he was an actor, he would be in Hollywood kind of trying to chase the dream or whatever. But as a performer who wants to do live things, there isn't a whole, you know, this is where you would come.
Did you have much support from the local community in making the film?
Yeah, you know what, that's another reason we just love shooting in Vegas. Like, we've never really... I have friends who've moved out to L.A., and we, you know, I go out there and visit, and I like it, but out there, everybody's trying to make a movie, and nobody really cares about you. You can make friends who will try, but, like, the city as a whole, like, if they encourage people to just run out into the street and shoot movies, you literally have somebody shooting a movie on every block, every day, all the time, because that's all everyone wants to do. Whereas here in Vegas, it's actually pretty great how excited people get when you're trying to make a movie and how supportive people are. Like, you know, we shot in that theater. The theater owner just let us come in every day for free. It's really best exemplified by there's a big street performing competition scene at the end. And, you know, in the story, there's a cash prize that's sort of significant. So we wanted, you know, obviously you can't shoot a scene where there's supposed to be a cash prize that's significant and only have like five people in the crowd. So we put out a call on Facebook basically just saying, hey, come be extras in this thing. And, you know, we didn't have any money, so we paid people, and it'd be real hard to mobilize a giant crowd, I think, in most cities. But we were thinking, okay, if we get like 20 people, we could try to be creative and, you know, put them in front of the camera, and we'll just have to shoot selectively and try to fake it and make it feel like a crowd. But we had like 200 people show up, and a lot of them hung out for like 4 or 5 hours. We tried to make it so people could come and go as they pleased, you know. And then at the peak hours where the first people who got there were getting ready to want to leave, and the people who were going to stay till the end were just showing up, when we had peak hours, that's when we got all our wide shots. You know, it was really, really amazing and wonderful how supportive everybody was. I don't know very many towns where you can just have 200 people show up for free.
There's another interesting character in the film, the voice of the fabled West.
You listen here and you listen, but good. I'm talking to you as the voice of the fabled American West.
There's always going to be coyotes on that dusty trail we got to walk.
But when I look at you, I see the American dream personified. When you run out of water, you drink the sand.
Was there a specific iconic cowboy that he was channeling there? Was that a John Wayne or a Clint Eastwood, or was it just supposed to be all of the great cowboys wrapped together?
Yeah, he was basically bouncing around between them. He would do John Wayne, and then he would do Clint Eastwood, and then he did Jimmy Stewart a few times. We would have him lapse into whatever voice seemed like it made sense at the time when he was trying to be, you know, when he was trying to be tough guy, he'd be Clint Eastwood, and when he was trying to be sort of determined, he'd be John Wayne, and when he was trying to be fatherly and offer advice, we had him lapse into some Jimmy Stewart. And it's funny because there's a character called Space Mime that's one of my favorite things in the movie, but in the first draft of the script, he was the space cowboy who sang, you know. And then Mike came up with, he wanted that the voice to show up and offer advice all over the place, so then we had to change that to something else, and then it became Space Lime, and then his act ended up being my favorite thing in the movie. But Space Lime's actually my brother. He's the co-director.
Pleasure doing business with you, clown guy. Oh, one more thing, though. If we catch you on our turf again, we're gonna put you in a box. Except the box we bury you in will not be imaginary.
So, yeah, we wrote that, and he's like, I want to do that. And I was like, okay. So we didn't really audition anything. When you write and direct the movie, you can just cast yourself. The act he did at the end, it's kind of funny, and I don't know that people realize it, but that was pretty much live. I mean, the whole act, he's basically doing that. It's one of those things where it's so interesting and cool, but I don't know that there's any way for us to get across what was happening, because it was all of that animation and stuff that's being projected over the top of him is... It was happening live. It was just the camera was pointed at him doing that, and it's like there was a white light that was, I mean, in the projector that's motion tracking his body while he's doing that, and the other stuff is like attached to him and whatever. It's pretty technically cool and interesting and advanced, all that stuff he was doing. And he and a good friend of ours who put that whole thing together. It's pretty awesome.
I enjoyed that whole projection mapping scene. I was going to ask you if that was actually done live, or if that it definitely felt live. It felt right. I like the way that you kind of struck a perfect balance of it being epic, you know, and grand, but at the same time it felt just within the realm of possibility of what, you know, of what the space mime could have, you know, come up with on his own for a local talent show like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're going for. And it was one take. It was just a camera on a tripod pointed at him actually doing that. So yeah, it was just projection maps. We have a buddy who's really good at that, and they worked that out together. He wrote the song too. His name's Brett. He's real talented.
Who did all the choreography for some of the more elaborate scenes, like the first theater stage production that goes awry?
That stuff's mostly Gregory. We write all the lines. It's funny, the script was only like 70 pages, because it's like we write all the lines and then they chase around and there's gags and stuff. So yeah, that whole thing. I mean, you know, we kind of help him. He's real good at coming up with gags, sometimes making them logically make sense or be motivated by something, which isn't the most important part, but, you know, sometimes we'll help kind of piece it together and fill in gaps. But as far as most of the physical comedy, that was all Gregory. A lot of it's based on, you know, he has a show that's like an hour and a half in Vegas, but he could do 4 hours or 5 hours. He felt like he has so many just crazy tricks he can do. A lot of it he doesn't do in a show because he's, you know, but he can just do so many crazy things. He can pretty much balance anything and throw anything and catch it anywhere he wants, you know.
Were there a lot of difficult choices that you guys had to make in the editing room?
Yeah, you know what? Our first cut was 45 minutes longer. On the DVD, there's like a half an hour of deleted scenes. A lot of it was just kind of trying to find the tone. unfortunately for Gregory, a lot of the stuff we cut was more slapsticky kind of physical comedy type stuff, because it's a delicate tone because it is kind of a silly, surreal sort of cartoony movie, but we didn't want to go too far. We wanted to actually kind of feel something and have a little bit of indie soul, because that's sort of who we are. So, and you never know how things are going to feel while you're shooting it. Sometimes, you know, you sort of find the tone afterwards. So some of the goofier, cartoonier scenes got cut, even though they're funny and they work by themselves. As a family movie and a movie we wanted kids to be able to enjoy, we were trying to keep it short because they get bored. You know, we felt pretty strongly that usually we would just let the movie be what it wants to be, but we felt pretty strongly that we should try to keep it under 90 minutes or right around there. And our first cut was 2 hours and 15, which is, you know, long. So we just started, we were like, man, we got to cut a lot. And so anything that bothered either one of us even a little bit, we just got rid of it. And it was, in some places it was hard, but it ended up, it was a really good experience because it tightened it way down and it moves a lot faster and, you know, made some hard cuts.
Did you ever consider making it as a silent film? Because I felt there were a lot of aspects of it where I felt like it almost was a silent film if it weren't for some of the few lines of spoken dialogue and, you know, the handheld camera. But so much of the story and the slapstick comedy and the music just really sort of felt like that whole kind of silent film era. Was that something you were intentionally going for, or was that just that, did that just come naturally?
Oh yeah, it was definitely intentional. I mean, like the nobody speaks for the first 10 minutes of the movie, and that was intentional. Although in the script we had some dialogue, and then as we were cutting, I was like, you know, none of this dialogue is even necessary. We should really just make the whole first 10 minutes sort of an homage to silent film. So that was very much intentional. We kind of almost wanted the whole first, and it almost works as a short film where, you know, he's performing and then he feeds those animals in the junkyard. That almost works as a nice little self-contained thought that introduces you to him and makes you like him. And we didn't think any words were necessary. So what little words we had, we cut. And it was intentional. We were like, wow, this is like a silent movie for 10 minutes. We thought that was great because, you know, he's very much trying to evoke Chaplin and Buster Keaton. Those are heroes of his. So we sort of thought it'd be a really nice little nod to it.
He doesn't speak in his stage act, does he?
He speaks a little bit, very little though. In his stage act, when there are lines and stuff, a lot of it's like pre-recorded sort of voices that he has done. But honestly, I wouldn't tell him this, but I feel like his act's great when it's silent. You know, a lot of the time he feels like he wants to explain things, but it's like, you don't need to explain what you're doing. It's awesome. But he does speak a little bit in his act, but not a lot.
What was sort of the approximate, if it's okay to share, what was the, sort of the approximate budget range of your film?
It was about $30,000. Yeah, it was very little, and, you know, most of it, Mike and I, we own a portion of the movie, so I donated my equipment, and we, you know, directed and wrote it for free and edited it for points, essentially, but the rest of the crew all got paid a little bit, which is where a lot of the money went, and, you know, feeding people, that's pretty much it, but yeah, it wasn't a lot.
Where did you premiere it?
It premiered at Dances with Films in L.A., and then it played at the Austin Film Festival. It ended up winning audience awards in both of those. And then it played at the Las Vegas Film Festival, and it had a limited theatrical release in Las Vegas. It played every day for a couple of weeks, I think. And then it's played in a few other film festivals, so it's done pretty well.
If people aren't able to make it to the Catalina Film Society screening on Wednesday night, where else might audiences find your film?
If you want to watch it in HD, you can download it on Amazon or on iTunes. There are DVDs for sale. I think you can buy them on BestBuy.com. DVD is good because it's got a lot of, you know, for such a low-budget movie, there are a lot of, sounds like I'm giving it a hard sale, and I'm sorry, but on the DVD, there are a lot of special features that are actually really fun. There are two or three short films, and there's like a half an hour of deleted scenes, and they're actually good deleted scenes, just tonally, they didn't completely fit, and also, you know, we just had to shorten it.
And you said that you're working with Gregory on a possible sequel or another children's show spinoff?
Well, it's not really a sequel. It's just a second movie. He loves this movie, and he's proud of it, but it's funny because a lot of it's him, but it was kind of more the movie we wanted to make because we were working for free. But he had a lot of ideas that are a little more of the physical comedy and slapstick type stuff. So we actually just had our first production meeting with him today. He wrote an outline and Mike's writing the script, but Gregory's going to direct this one, and it'll be a little sillier. It's still going to be really funny, but it's going to be a lot more slapstick and physical comedy type stuff. Today was the first really good, long, hard conversation we had about it, and it's actually really funny. I actually got pretty excited about it today.
Do you think you're going to shoot it in Vegas again, or do you think you're going to have to shoot it in Hollywood?
Yeah, we'll definitely shoot it here. It won't be set in Vegas, though. He's in a traveling circus, and then he leaves, and he's trying to get to Hollywood, and he gets stranded in a small town and has a bunch of misadventures trying to get jobs there.
Nice.
So it'll be set in, you know, just kind of in, you know, a random small town, but it'll be shot around here because that's where we are.
This tremendous film. Congratulations on creating this and on such a small budget and really just pulling out some great character work out of your cast and Gregory and Space Mime and Cowboy, just memorable characters. You guys really really pulled off a nice family oriented film. It's just a real treat to watch.
Well, thank you very much, man. I appreciate that.
The wind, it does blow. It'll blow you this way and that your whole life. Until one day you stop long enough to wipe the dust out of your eyes and realize that old wind has blown you right where you need it to be. Now sit on back and hear the tale of a man they call Popovich. A man who blew into the Old West with nothing at all but the American dream in his heart. A tried and true tale of lemons to lemonade.
The Catalina Film Society presents a special screening of Popovich and the Voice of the Fabled American West on Wednesday, August 19th at the historic Overlook Hall located at 209 East Whidley Avenue in the town of Avalon on Catalina Island. The screening is a community event, and admission is free, with a suggested $10 donation benefiting the Catalina Island Foundation. Snacks and beverages will be provided, and the show starts at 7 p.m. For further questions about the screening, visit overlookhall.com.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio. on KISO 88.7
Avalon.